This is just the opening of the book. Baldwin is at Columbia University, and he is about to walk on stage. He adjusts the microphone, clears his throat, and he says, "Good evening. I am a cooling, agile Black Harlem cat. Those of you who have heard something about me prior to this evening, or who know me, or perhaps have heard something of the name or read one of the novels or essays, indeed know I've been in utter seclusion for hundreds of years, so it seems. But as you can see, I am still very much alive. The Harlem cat is alive. In spite of my well-publicized funeral at St. John the Divine, not very many blocks from this historic place."
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with writer Vincent Tolliver about his play, James Baldwin, Striking a Match to America, an address at Columbia University.
I imagine Baldwin still alive and decided to place this address at Columbia University, which of course is in the backyard of where he was born in Harlem.
Honest and straightforward talk about James Baldwin and race in America. And we'll listen as Vincent Tolliver performs from his one-man play, and we'll hear actual excerpts of Baldwin from his speeches, his singing, and his debates on Arts and Letters.
"Since I've had no public outings, I have been completely underground, and I have traveled exclusively under the cover and protection of darkness at odd and unusual hours of the night."
From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today, we'll be talking with writer Vincent Tolliver about his play, Imagining, an address that James Baldwin would be giving in the present.
"What I will tell you is I'm the better for the years I have been out of the glaring public light, for the years I've spent alone, for the years of silence. One can learn a great deal in silence. Anxiety and nervousness no longer cause my heart to flutter like the undeveloped wings of an infant bird before its first flight."
This one-man play, which has been performed in various cities across the United States, strikes a match and fuels our discussion on race and racism in America.
Baldwin was one of the most fascinating orators to watch. And what separated him from others was his passion. When Baldwin spoke, you felt the passion. You felt the authenticity. You felt the truth. You felt the despair. Everything was at work in the speech.
Vincent Tolliver, welcome.
Thank you, Brad. I am thrilled to be here.
I'm thrilled to have you here. Let's talk about some of James Baldwin's talks. He actually gave talks at a variety of universities.
That's right, yeah.
And this one, Striking a Match to America, is kind of a fictional address.
That's right. As you know, this is a transcript of a play that I wrote and that has been produced in several cities, including Atlanta and Los Angeles, and most recently at the Writers Guild of America Theater in Beverly Hills. "My sleep is sound, and I am almost at peace. If you have lived, and I don't mean in the innocuous way, then you know this road getting here wasn't easily traveled. I have been pounced upon, and quite necessarily for my own survival, I have learned to pounce. More about pouncing, surviving the novel, the essays, and my beloved America a bit later. By the way, my name is James Baldwin."
It's interesting, too, because when you look at some of the YouTube videos of Baldwin talking to most of the academics. Most are white. Mm-hmm. But he waxes so poetically. And even when he's talking about things that might well upset them,
sure,
he does it so intellectually and so well that I think it's just brilliant.
Yeah, it is brilliant.
When I was growing up, I was taught in American history books that Africa had no history, and neither did I. That I was a savage, about whom the less said the better, who had been saved by Europe and brought to America. And of course, I believed it. I didn't have much choice. Those are the only books there were.
It's one of the abilities of Baldwin that's sort of unmatched today. He'll feed you tough love, if you will, but he'll do it in a delicate way. It's stuff that you may not want to hear, you may not want to admit, you may not want to own, but Baldwin never shies from the truth.
It is a terrible thing for an entire people to surrender to the notion that 1/9 of its population is beneath them. And until that moment, until the moment comes when we, the American people, are able to accept the fact that I have to accept, for example, that my ancestors are both white and black, that on that continent we are trying to forge a new identity for which we need each other, and that I am not a ward of America.
What interests you in James Baldwin? I think myself, he is really an unparalleled American writer.
Well, first and foremost, Baldwin, for me, was really one of the only writers able to articulate the race problem in America in terms no one else was able to do so. And so Baldwin always reminded us that we shouldn't shy away from the truth. We were in a time, and we're still in that time today, because I think about the American political landscape today, and I think about all the things that Baldwin warned us about, or attempted to warn us about, that still resonates today.
One of the great things that the white world does not know, but I think I do know, is that black people are just like everybody else. One has used the myth of Negro and the myth of color to pretend and to assume that you are dealing essentially with something exotic, bizarre, and practically, according to human laws, unknown. Alas, that is not true. We are also mercenaries, dictators, murderers, liars. We are human too.
And so Baldwin was very interested in America telling the truth, particularly white America. He was very interested in uncovering the big lie, the big myth. For example, Baldwin said a very long time ago that the so-called white people in this country didn't become white until they arrived from Europe. And so the big challenge for me in America is that if you are going to attempt to solve the race problem that exists today, one of the first things you have to do is you have to take whiteness out of the vocabulary, because there are no white people in America and there are no black people in America. There are Americans who are descendants of Africa. They would be black. There are whites that are descendants of Europe or Spain or wherever else. They're white. But the actual identifiers, white and black, as it relates to human beings, is really a fallacy. It is a social and political construct,
right,
which is why we can't ever really rise out of what I call this security cesspool that we find ourselves in when we have these race talks.
I was right. That's part of the dilemma of being an American Negro, that one is a little bit colored and a little bit white. And not only in terms, in physical terms, in the head and in the heart.
Let's continue our conversation with Vincent Tolliver as he performs from his one-man play, James Baldwin, Striking a Match to America, an address at Columbia University.
So when one is forced to accept, forced because the double-barrel shotgun has moved center stage and is staring him directly in the face, it is really no easy matter. In my particular case, this struggling with identity and accepting the associated guilt has been exasperated because I have been ferociously resisting it for over half my life.
And you write in this, people are not going to want to hear this. people need to hear it.
Sure.
But they're not going to want to hear it.
Sure.
And particularly probably at Columbia, most of the folks that he'd be talking to.
Yeah.
So how did you do the research for this? I know you've been a scholar of Baldwin for a long, long time.
Well, 25 plus years, probably closer to 30 now, I've been a student of Baldwin. And so when you study someone for as long as I have studied Baldwin, when you read the works, and I pick up the works all the time, right? I don't just sort of read them and throw them on the shelf. I revisit. Like, for example, this weekend, I decided to reread The Evidence of Things Not Seen. And I don't know if you're familiar with that work, but that is the work where Playboy commissioned him to go down to Atlanta and to do an essay relating to the Atlanta child murders, which would have been in the late 70s or early 80s. And so I'm rereading that work now, and it's just amazing how that work still resonates today, which all of Baldwin's works, particularly the essays. And so in the research for my book, I thought, what can I do that takes a leap from what we already know, from what we've already seen? What can I do that really gets to the heart of Baldwin and really fresh? And so the challenge for me was, all right, let's make Baldwin alive today, because we still love Baldwin. We talk about Baldwin. We can't get enough of Baldwin. You know, Baldwin is in zeitgeist. At my age, I no longer have a place to hide my face. It's as if the Rock of Ages has played a terrible trick on me and once and for all has forced my hand, and at precisely the same time, bitterly betrayed me, just like in that old Negro spiritual. I went to the rock to hide my face, but the rock cried out, "No hiding place."
I went to the rock to hide my face, but the rock cried out, "No."
Speaking as a writer again, sometimes you're writing a page or a sentence and you have to change a word in the sentence. And when you change that word, you move that word out or put another word in, you've changed the entire page. You change the entire page. Now, one could consider that what we as Americans are going through as we approach the end of the 20th century, it might be useful to change a single word. We talk about the black problem. It might be interesting to see what would happen to the page if one decided to discuss the white problem.
And it resonates. What he's talking about is as true today as it was then.
That's exactly right, but unfortunately we have failed to heed the warnings. We have failed to act on the warnings. And so we always find ourselves going back to Baldwin, I guess, for lessons or inspirations. But, you know, I'm reminded of a speech he gave back in the 60s, and it was a speech called A Talk to Teachers. You know, what was interesting in that speech is that he put right on the forefront that the treatment of African-American boys and girls was directly tied to the survival of the country. There was a line in it that said, talking about America, "If you are compelled to lie about one aspect of anybody's history, you must lie about it all. If you have to lie about my real role here, if you have to pretend that I hold all that cotton just because I love you, then you have done something to yourself. You are mad."
Look, the truth is, it's very hard to talk about education in this country without talking about the whole society in which it mainly fails to occur. You can hardly talk about schools, you know, without talking about cities. And the cities are in the hands of financiers. The cities are in the hands of pirates, thugs. And our children, therefore, are victims of this. Are victims of the principles according to which the country is run. A country is not run according to the, you know, either the will of its citizens, I hope, or the good of its citizens, I know that, but for profit, for money, to make money. And education is a $1 billion industry. And the least important part of that industry is the child.
So to put it bluntly, America really doesn't care and will not care care as long as the cash register's receipts continue to increase.
Baldwin says, what can we do? Well, we can hold everybody accountable for inaction and action.
That's exactly right. And so that hasn't been done. And so we have to be in the business of holding people accountable.
Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on, let me stand. I'm tired, I'm weak, I'm worn through storm.
These awful and relentless demons that I am speaking of have literally plagued me for what now seems like millennia. Since the days of my turbulent youth on the avenue where I bore witness to various and sundry unscrupulous acts that were part of life in Harlem and indeed part of life surreptitiously woven deeply into the American fabric. Although these unspeakable activities greatly consumed my young, impressionable mind at the time, I still managed somehow to regard them as unclean, disgusting, and certainly unholy.
Let's talk a little bit about mendacity and the church.
Sure.
He would need to speak about the church, his relationship to the church which he loved and didn't.
There's even one quote that I really love of Baldwin where he said, if the concept of God has any validity or any use, it can only be to make us loving, more caring, and freer. And if God cannot do this, it's time we got rid of him.
Precious Lord, and lead me on.
My sleep is sound and I am almost at peace. If you have lived, and I don't mean in the innocuous way, then you know this road getting here wasn't easily traveled.
First house I remember was on Park Avenue, Uptown Park Avenue, where the railroad tracks are. I was the oldest, so I took care of the kids and dealt with Daddy. My understanding much better now. Part of his problem was he couldn't feed his kids. But I was a kid and I didn't know that. And he was very religious, very rigid.
Baldwin, let's just take his name, James Baldwin. Well, that really wasn't his name. When his mother married David Baldwin, Baldwin was almost 2 years old, like 1.5 years old. And so his mother's maiden name is Jones. Well, so on Baldwin's birth certificate, his original birth certificate, the name that appeared is James Jones. Well, that name wasn't quite right either because that wasn't the last name of his father.
In fact, in a word, he wanted power. He wanted Negroes to do, in effect, what he imagined white people did. That is to have, to own the houses, to own U.S. Steel. And this is what, in effect, killed him because there was something in him which could not bend. He could only be broken.
And his father was a minister, wasn't he?
That's exactly right. And also Baldwin was a minister. He was in the pulpit from the age of 14 to 17, or perhaps even 13 to 17. And even that act was in defiance of the father, David Baldwin, because he realized that if he were in the pulpit as this minister, there were times as he prepared his sermons that he was off limits. So the father would not be able to menace him. When he was preparing his sermon, that was his time and isolated him from everyone else. And the father, being a minister, respected that and was hands off. Even the act of him becoming a child minister was a direct defiance of the father. Mm-hmm. Because my hand has been rightly forced, now I must face my own identity demons. For many years, I have wondered silently about who and what I really am. This basic question has succeeded in eluding me for so very long, and I have been going to pieces searching for the answers. I have attempted to wring out every drop of meaning from any and everything in my past that could have possibly been a clue. So Baldwin had this sort of identity thing going on with the fact that his last name wasn't really Baldwin. I mean, Baldwin was his stepfather. Baldwin was his name, but really that really wasn't the name. And so he'd come to fame, if you will, under the name of his stepfather, who he did not get along with, of course.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's continue our conversation with Vincent Tolliver about his one-man play, James Baldwin, Striking a Match to America, an address at Columbia University.
The following program is from NET, the National Educational Television Network.
And you know, he did the debate, that great debate that he did against William Buckley at Cambridge in
right.
October of 1965, called Is the American Dream at the Expense of the American Negro?
Debate. James Baldwin versus William Buckley. Subject. Has the American dream been achieved at the expense of the American Negro?
I'm terrified at the moral apathy, the death of the heart, which is happening in my country. These people have deluded themselves for so long that they really don't think I'm human. I have basis on their conduct, not on what they say. And this means that they have become, in themselves, moral monsters.
If you have lied about someone else's history, then that means that you have also had to lie about your own history. And so in the case of America, America has done nothing but lie about history. And just keep in mind, when you think about where we are in America, and when you think about this whole notion of whites and blacks, and when you think about the history of black Americans in this country, and you think about the very insidious behavior, the very evil behavior acted out in the bodies, in the persons, in the minds of black Americans by white Americans, there has got to be a whole lot of guilt associated with that. And if there isn't any guilt associated with that, then you really have to be a moral monster.
There are days, this is one of them, when you wonder what your role is in this country and what your future is in it. How precisely you're going to reconcile yourself to your situation here, and how you're going to communicate to the vast, heedless, unthinking, cruel white majority that you are here.
Furthermore, from a slightly different angle, but no less horrendous, the institution of slavery has and is still working an insidious cruelty at this very hour, robbed black Americans of family, spirit, identity, and self, education, opportunity, land, and cash. Yes, coal, hard cash, and millions of acres of land. This monstrous and despicable thievery of black Americans' property and person has gone unchecked and unpunished. The catastrophic damage has not been adequately assessed or seriously examined on any level. But what needs neither assessment nor examination is the fact that America has been shamefully heartless and overtly ruthless in her dealings with human beings and owes a great debt. At some point, there must be a wide-scale demand for the cash owed. Black Americans simply must collect the debt America owes them.
So I starred this section. If America were ever to admit to any wrongdoing, then she would also be forced to act,
sure,
to compensate, to right a wrong, to be morally reproached, to show her crimson hands, which have been bloodied by millions of black human lives.
It is absolutely true. The whole notion that human beings experienced chattel slavery for 400 plus years and are legally deemed property. And when you advance from that, you create prison systems, which in a number of ways is just an extension of the slavery. And so what will become of the country if we don't come to the table and be honest about what has happened and be honest about what it takes to move us forward?
We are sitting in this room, and we are all, at least we like to think we are, relatively civilized. And we can talk to each other at least on certain levels. So that we could walk out of here assuming that the measure of our enlightenment, or at least our politeness, has some effect on the world. It may not.
Changing gears, as we are now in the home stretch, I would like to talk a bit about the essays and the novels and what I have attempted to do with the language in them. Upon the American conscience, I have pounced and tried my damnedest to engender flashes of a pictorial journey representing a scarred past, a tested present, and a rather uncertain future. The language is not meant to be casual or loose. Instead, it is meant to be formal and rigid, stiff. In the writing, my desire has been to transpose the mirror inward and force the reflection outward, juxtaposing the reflected inward self to a distorted reality which is neither genuine or honest. The best I have dared hope for is a collusion between delusion and denial.
So imagining Baldwin speaking today, and he talks a little about compensation, he talks a little about holding people accountable, he talks a little about looking into the mirror. Where does this leave us?
It leaves us with a decision to make. And it also prompts us to look in the mirror. And so once we have done that, what will we do? Will we act or will we continue to go along business as usual? So it is certainly a call to action. And so we can all look in the mirror and figure out a course of action, or figure out if we are going to continue to go about our daily lives normally, or will we do something different?
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to the musicianship of Tim Anthony and Alvis Diop. And a special thanks to musician Rodney Block, whose trumpet provided so much of the soundscape for this episode. Thanks to Mary Ellen Cubitt and William Wagner for the story editing advice. Thank you to Adam Simon of Simon Sound for mastering the episode. Thank you to the Sheraton Four Points by Marriott Little Rock for supplying rooms to singers, songwriters, and guests of Arts and Letters. Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas. Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to writer Vincent Tolliver for your one-man play that extends the legacy of James Baldwin and is an invitation to look in the mirror and a peroration, a call to action.
Not only is there a call to action in the book, But there is a call of action today in American politics. The days of waiting should be over, and are over, as far as I'm concerned.
For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of James Baldwin. Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced.